from KERA in Dallas. This is Think. I'm John McKay, sitting in for Chris Boyd. In the Western Hemisphere, one nation stands as the preeminent influencer. Since the American founding, others have tried to supplant us and failed. And that, Sean Mirsky of the Hoover Institute tells us, is just how the founders planned it. Staying on top has not always been pretty, not always been without force, but like it or not, it's been the key and consistent policy that has kept the old world's great powers from too much interference in the nations of the new world. Sean Mirsky is an author, scholar, attorney. His new book is We May Dominate the World, Ambition, Anxiety, and the Rise of the American Colossus. Sean, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure to be here, John.
You know, it really, I guess, should come as no surprise to anybody that the great powers have dominated international politics in the past. But today, the United States is much more than a great power, you say. You refer to us as a regional hegemon. So let's start there. What does that mean?
So that's exactly right. Great powers are the nations in international politics that, you know, have the most force. They have the greatest militaries, the greatest political and economic influence. But above great powers, there's another ranking, and that's regional hegemons. And those are great powers that don't have any other great power in their immediate neighborhood. In other words, they dominate their neighborhood so completely that every great power is essentially an ocean's length away. And in modern history, there's only ever been one great power that's managed to accomplish that, and that's the United States. And it's a big deal because it means that we have facing no challengers at our immediate doors. We can kind of go around the world and intervene in places, you know, as far flung as Asia, the Middle East, Europe, without really needing to worry about the consequences back home.
You know, I guess the thing that probably comes to folks' mind at when they first hear that is China then is not a regional hegemon yet.
Not yet. And that's because for a couple different reasons. First, there's other powers in its neighborhood like Russia and Japan and India. And you can argue about exactly whether they're great powers, but they're certainly powerful enough to, you know, to give China pause. But the bigger issue is that the U.S. military and the U.S. itself is still a presence in East Asia in a way that means that China is not the only great power in that area of the world.
So in the modern era, I'm trying to go back a little period of time, Napoleonic France, for example, or Imperial Japan, what about them?
So both nations, along with countries like Imperial Germany and Nazi Germany, became powerful enough that they thought they could become regional hegemons. And so they made runs at it, attempting to essentially gain that status by force, by conquering all the other great powers in their neighborhood. But none of them succeeded. Imperial Japan obviously fell to the United States, as did Nazi Germany and then Imperial Germany. And even Napoleonic France eventually got stopped by both Great Britain and Russia. But they all came close, but none quite succeeded.
You know, the other amazing thing about this is that any that would have tried, even if they had done this for a little while, they did not do it for as long as the United States has held on to this position for so long.
Exactly. And, you know, it's made a massive difference in the way that the United States conducts its foreign policy. And so one of the points that I make in the book is that during the Cold War, our entire strategy was containing the Soviet Union, which from our perspective, obviously, was a much better situation than a Cold War in which the Soviet Union was trying to contain us. And the reason that, you know, the shoe was on the foot that it was on is precisely because we didn't really have to worry about, you know, the Soviet Union coming in and planting itself in the Western Hemisphere during the Cold War, except, you know, during crises like the Cuban Missile Crisis. But for the most part, everything was taking place in Eurasia, in large part because we had this unassailable status in the Western Hemisphere.
You know, there have been a lot of books that have been written about this period and talking about the relationship between the United States and the nations that are to our south and the troubles between all of us. But usually what we hear is that we were following our business interests in taking actions when we did. But you focus on this country's concern about any existential threats. and our response to those threats, that that's what this has really all been about. Is that right?
That's correct. It's certainly a complicated story. Business interests enter the picture. So do other factors that, you know, we can discuss. But the point that I make in the book is that, you know, as far back as a century and a half ago, or even two centuries ago, actually, the United States was primarily concerned about keeping foreign great powers out of the hemisphere, precisely so it could attain this regional hegemon status. The argument that I make in the book is that as Europe's great powers during the Second Age of Imperialism went on this colonialist tear through the rest of the world, the United States became very, very concerned that Europe was going to descend on the Western Hemisphere and start recolonizing Latin America. And the point that I make is that much of our foreign policy, which was very, very aggressive and offensive in the way it manifested, was in many ways a defensive measure against the risk that we saw of Europe coming into the hemisphere and, you know, establishing military forces right on our borders.
Yeah, you know, because we don't really teach about some of these concerns that, for example, Thomas Jefferson had, or if you look at, you point out George Washington's farewell address, the things that they were concerned about with regard to other nations, other powers coming in here. We don't really point that out, but those were things that were really on their mind at the time.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's, you know, especially at the founding of the country, you know, you had 13 colonies that were clinging to the eastern seaboard, and everywhere you looked, there were hostile great powers, Great Britain, France, even Spain to a certain extent at that point. And for the United States, I mean, the first and kind of most important goal was expanding territorially until, you know, the country had established enough of a foothold that it could, you know, defend itself. And so if you look at American history, basically through the U.S. Civil War, a huge part of American foreign policy was focused on, you know, filling out the continent. And the story, I think, is, you know, familiar for many listeners, you know, and it included everything from kind of heroic tales on the frontier to also, you know, the subjugation of the Indian tribes that, you know, were living there. But all of it took place, I think, in the shadow of this great power competition with, you know, powers in Europe. And so things like, you know, the Louisiana Purchase and the Mexican-American War and all these kind of individual incidents that you can point to were oftentimes, you know, taking place in this broader global framework. And that's certainly the way that American policymakers understood it.
You know, and we make the mistake, I think, at times of thinking that this is a sort of an idea of isolationism. But this is really trying really to survive as a nation at this particular period with regard to their strength and the powers that are in Europe.
That's exactly right. And I think Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has said, you know, if we are so isolationist, then how did we end up growing so big? And I think that's exactly right. The United States was isolationist towards Europe in the sense that it did not want to get involved with Europe politically in a way that might bring European great powers down on the United States' head because, you know, there's some war and they want the United States to take sides or anything like that. But when it comes to the Western Hemisphere, the United States has never been isolationist. It has always been very engaged politically and oftentimes very engaged militarily as well.
You know, there are, if you look at, for example, even the Federalist Papers, there's some parts in there, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's Alexander Hamilton who talks about this vision of the New World and a concern about making sure there's a separation from the old world and the European power. So this is even before there is a United States.
Oh, yes. I think the idea very much stretches back, you know, to the way that the founding fathers were thinking about it, you know, even before we won the Revolutionary War. I mean, the challenge that the United States faced when it was first came onto the international scene is that it had a form of government democracy that every other nation in the world essentially was hostile towards, mm-hmm. you know, because the very existence of our democracy was in a lot of ways a threat to the old world powers because it gave their people, you know, a potential alternative model of government that, of course, the monarchies there didn't necessarily appreciate. And so there was this understanding that even when great powers like France, for instance, were allying with the United States, they were doing so merely, you know, out of convenience and merely to advance their own interests in the balance of power. But there was never any sort of long-term love between the United States and these other old world countries. And so there was this sense among the founding generation that on the one hand, that democracy was on the march and that in the long run, it would prevail and, you know, prove itself to be the best form of government. But there was also the understanding that you would never get to the long term if you didn't protect American interests now. And so, as I mentioned, that led to a lot of the initial expansion, as well as the way that the, you know, initial leaders of the country framed their relationship with Europe.
Yeah, I mean, there were three very powerful monarchies at the time. You've got Prussia, you've got Russia, you've got Austria. They're going to come together to form, I guess, what's called the Holy Alliance. And as you say, there is this very real fear in Europe that this republicanism that they're talking about in terms of the United States, they're concerned about that idea coming to where they live.
Yeah, and the timing of all this created a very interesting situation for the United States. So the Napoleonic Wars were raging on the European continent, you know, during the better part of the 1790s, the 1800s, and the 1810s. And during that, during those wars, the colonies of Spain and Portugal essentially ended up declaring independence, in large part because Spain and Portugal were being occupied by Napoleon, and there was all this stuff happening on the continent that was distracting Madrid and Lisbon from sort of tending to their colonial empires. And so by the early 1820s, much of Latin America has gained its independence from Europe. But at the same time, by this point, Napoleonic France has been defeated, and these monarchical powers that you mentioned, along with France as well, have sort of come together to create this holy alliance that is explicitly dedicated to stamping out classical liberalism in Europe. And there's this concern that culminates in 1823 that if the United States doesn't do something about it, there's a very real risk that the European powers are going to come back into Latin America in an effort to restore these former colonies to Spain and Portugal. And so, in essence, to recolonize the hemisphere. And that's the situation that leads to the famous Monroe Doctrine that many listeners will know from, you know, their U.S. history classes.
Yeah, so that's 1823, and for the United States and for the doctrine itself, you're calling this a problem of order and the need to avoid any kind of instability, to make sure that if there is some instability in the Western Hemisphere, that would be a reason that the old powers would want to come over here.
That's exactly right. At a certain point, the United States just grows powerful enough that it's not really worried about any European nation attacking it directly, or at least that's not as realistic a threat as some others. Instead, what the United States is actually worried about is Europe attacking one of its neighbors and taking over one of its neighbors, and then using that as a sort of foothold to expand across the rest of the hemisphere in a way that ends up directly challenging U.S. interests. And so the way that the U.S. thinks about it, it realizes that a vulnerability anywhere in its neighborhood is a vulnerability for itself and a vulnerability for the neighborhood as a whole. And so a huge part of U.S. foreign policy ends up being oriented towards stabilizing and strengthening its immediate neighbors in an effort to basically, you know, have them stand up on their own two feet and be in a position where they could defend themselves from European influence.
So if our friends are strong over here and we're strong, we don't have too much concern with regard to the old countries coming back over here and trying to gain a foothold.
Exactly. And it's not even, in a lot of ways, it's not even that the United States wanted its friends to be strong. There were many governments in Latin America, especially as, you know, the wave of interventionism that I describe in my book happened. There were many countries that had fairly anti-American sort of stances. You know, they frequently criticized the United States and were quite critical of American foreign policy. But, you know, from the U.S. perspective, this wasn't about propping up pro-American governments per se. It was more about just having governments that were stable enough that they wouldn't be pro-European, and in particular that they wouldn't be inviting or at least presenting the opportunity for European expansion. And so one example where this, I think, really just crystallizes is during the U.S. Civil War, because what ends up happening is that while the North and the South are at each other's throats, the old powers of Europe realize this is just a perfect opportunity to start getting more involved in the Western Hemisphere when the U.S. is too distracted to do anything about it. And so there's a number of examples of kind of European expansion during this time, but the most prominent one is France invades and occupies all of Mexico during the U.S. Civil War. And at some point, you know, French troops go right up to the border of the, you know, the Rio Grande. And this is a massive threat from the United States perspective, of course. The French military is at this point the world's greatest military, and having, you know, tens of thousands of French soldiers right on its border is not a situation that the United States wants to be in. And so, as you can imagine, the U.S., you know, reacts against this threat quite violently.
With the defeat of Napoleon in 1815, there is this growing concern in the United States that these major powers in Europe, they really truly might start thinking about recolonizing some of these American republics. And I'm not really talking so much about the United States, but they may be interested in some other countries in this hemisphere.
When Napoleon is defeated in 1815, most of Latin America is still fighting for its independence against Spain and Portugal. And so you have this widespread instability across the continent. And with the defeat of Napoleon, you also have these incredibly powerful states in Europe that now have a vested interest in restoring the Latin American colonies to their previous masters. And so from the United States perspective, there's this building sense during the 1810s and early 1820s that, you know, there may be a very real kind of European onslaught against the hemisphere very, very soon.
When all this is going on, and you've alluded to this, did the United States have the power, the military power to defend its interests at the time? Because all of these kingdoms, these old powers, these great powers that you're talking about, they are very powerful. So I'm not talking about the mid-19th century. I'm talking about the end of 17th century, beginning of, end of 18th century, beginning of 19th century. The United States really wasn't powerful enough to take these on, were they?
No. And so when the United States in 1823 declares the Monroe Doctrine and essentially erects a massive, you know, keep out sign in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, in a lot of ways, it's a totally futile gesture. Many of the European kingdoms heard about this declaration from President Monroe and literally laughed because it was just so ludicrous that this little nation on the other side of the ocean was, you know, had the gall to tell Europe what to do and what not to do, especially when it had no real navy or no real military to speak of. So instead, I mean, the U.S. largely gets lucky because at the time, Great Britain has the world's most powerful navy. And Great Britain, for various reasons, also has a vested interest in not having Europe recolonize the Western Hemisphere. And so in a lot of ways, the United States is the one who's making all the noises about what Europe can and can't do. But the actual enforcement falls to Great Britain itself.
You know, I would imagine one of the other things that would attract these great powers to the New World would be the growth in material wealth of this country as well as the years go on. Was that a factor too?
It was certainly a concern among Americans. And so by the time you get to, let's say, the 1870s or so, you know, the U.S. Navy that was really in fairly good shape by the end of the Civil War has completely fallen apart and just been, you know, essentially put into storage. And there's this growing concern among Americans that even the material wealth of the United States itself is going to be this treasure house that will beckon European powers to invade, and that really the United States has no recourse against that. And so you'll see these, you know, speeches given by congressmen and senators where they talk about the United States as this, you know, this great rich lady who's kind of has all these, you know, rings and fancy jewelry on, and who's just walking around with just no method of defense as they're, you know, through a neighborhood of, you know, fairly avaricious European powers who can, you know, should the inclination strike them, just, you know, reach out and start taking this. And so that is very much a concern that American leaders have.
One of the things that that's also not talked about is I would imagine that the Europeans watching the debate and the battle over slavery before the Civil War, and in fact during the Civil War, that kind of encourages them believing that maybe the United States, maybe this democratic form of government is not going to survive with this kind of a conflict going on.
Oh, they're thrilled about it. And I should say that there is oftentimes a distinction between the leadership of these European countries and the people. So in Great Britain, for instance, there's actually quite a lot of sympathy for the North and the kind of anti-slavery cause among most of the, you know, the working class people. But at least among the kind of policy leaders in countries like Great Britain and France, They are quite literally, you know, cackling over the possibility that the South is going to gain its independence, because from their perspective, they've been watching this democratic republic rise and rise and rise over the previous century and grow more and more powerful. And they understand that if nothing is done, the United States will continue to grow more powerful. And, you know, at that point, they're also just really concerned that the United States will actually just annex the entire Western Hemisphere. And so the second they see the South secede, they're thrilled because they think it's a potential opportunity to permanently disunite the United States and to set up two competing powers on the North American continent that will keep each other in check and, you know, mean that Europe will become less threatened. And so they're quite happy with the Civil War as it begins.
Spain really wants to get back in the game, so to speak, here, to get back in the hemisphere. They're going to start with the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, so in 1861, right at the time that the U.S. Civil War is starting, and in large part because the U.S. Civil War is starting, Spain ends up recolonizing the Dominican Republic with the Dominican Republic's consent, or at least the government's consent. And so this is actually one of the few examples in history you can find of a colony actually inviting the colonial power back to take the country over. And so Spain, recolonizes the Dominican Republic in 1861.
The French they aren't far behind. They want Mexico.
Exactly right. And so they initially send a joint expedition with Great Britain and Spain. And, you know, since Mexico gained independence, you know, the country has gone through dozens of presidents. Its treasury, to put it lightly, is bare, but more than that, it has racked up these claims that it owes to Europe. Some of it is just debt on contracts. Much of it is claims, you know, for damage to European citizens' lives or property. And so at this point, Europe's powers are just sick and tired sort of the way that they're being treated in Mexico. And so France organizes this coalition of powers to go in and essentially teach Mexico a lesson. But France actually has much, much deeper ulterior motives, which are to take over the entire country.
So the French actually put on an emperor on the throne and are hoping to reshape the hemisphere according to some grand design they have for the Americas.
That's exactly right. Emperor Napoleon III has what he calls the grand design for the Americas, which is basically this idea that you need to make the hemisphere safe for monarchy again. You need to turn first Mexico into a hereditary monarchy and then just start moving south, go through Central America, end up in South America, and turn all these countries into monarchies with ideally European princes on the throne.
They're really seeing Mexico as a beachhead, I guess, is the best way to put it, for these ideas that they want to bring back.
When writing the chapter on the French occupation of Mexico, the example that came to mind was actually the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, where, you know, I think a lot of the senior leadership in Washington sort of assumed we'd be greeted with open arms and that the Iraqis would be happy to be turned into democracy and that other states in the Middle East would quickly follow their example and soon you'd have an entire region that was made of democracies. France had the exact same idea back in the 1860s, except instead of democracy, it was monarchy. The French assumed that the Mexicans would greet them as liberators because the country was so disordered, so war-torn, there were so many revolutions, that Mexicans would be thrilled to have a European prince come in, establish order, and essentially give them the sort of government that they had, you know, at least in the French view, always wanted. But of course, that's not exactly the way it worked out, either in Iraq or in French-occupied Mexico.
Yeah, so this idea the founders have of ensuring stability and the countries of the Western Hemisphere to keep the old powers away. This really seems to be backed up in all of this, because the countries that we're talking about, what's attracted them to bringing them back, these old powers back, is instability.
And the point that I make in my book is that instability in the form of civil wars, revolutions, massive, you know, economic debt. I mean, the conditions that make a nation what we would call today a failing or failed state, those conditions present both an opportunity and a motivation for foreign intervention. The opportunity is there because when you're a divided state and you're warring, it's very easy for a foreign power to sort of come in, pick a side, and that side is happy to have the foreign power's help. And so, you know, one of the kind of the great lessons that these foreign powers learn is that it's so much easier to take over a state that's falling apart than it is to come in, you know, against a state that's strong. But there's also a lot of motivation to go in, which is when you have a state that's torn by civil war, you know, it's oftentimes racking up these enormous debts to these foreign powers. It oftentimes owes them enormous amounts of money for the harm that's befallen to their citizens and those citizens' property. And so there's oftentimes this perfect storm in these unstable states that really, I think, tempts foreign intervention in a way that, as you said, the United States can be very concerned about. And that's what happened in Mexico. And, you know, as the kind of U.S. policymakers are realizing at the time that the French are occupying Mexico, there's not that much that distinguishes Mexico from many other states in Latin America. And so they sort of wake up and realize that this is a fairly serious threat across the hemisphere.
You know, Ulysses Grant ends up sending Philip Sheridan to patrol the U.S.-Mexico border. And he says patrol, but quietly he's helping the rebels. And ultimately, the French will leave Mexico. And this was with all of this in mind that we're talking about.
Sheridan ends up on the Rio Grande with around 50,000 Union soldiers right at the end of the Civil War. And it's a remarkable moment in my mind, because the Civil War is the most destructive conflict that the United States had ever fought to that point or will ever fight. And the nevertheless, 3 months after the Civil War has finished, General Sheridan is on the border with 50,000 troops, and he's telling Washington, you need to let me cross. We need to invade Mexico and go to war with France to kick France out. And General Grant, who at this point is in charge of the U.S. armies, agrees and tells President Johnson, yes, this is what we need to do. And the Johnson's cabinet is bitterly divided. And so you have this moment where there's a very serious possibility of the U.S. going to war with the world's best military at the time, only a few months after the most destructive conflict it has ever fought. And I think just that moment itself really just stresses the stakes, or at least the way the stakes were understood by Americans, that they just could not tolerate these foreign great powers coming into their hemisphere and establishing a military presence.
I seem to recall a concept, manifest destiny, this idea about it was our destiny to do the things that we did do in terms of, I don't want to say conquer, but go across the United States. Does this play any role, this idea, this concept, in terms of what our thinking is at the time?
So it's an interesting question, because the concept of manifest destiny was more in vogue, I would say, in the 1840s and 1850s, particularly in conjunction with, you know, the expansion that occurred during the Mexican-American War. But by the time the Civil War finishes up and the North wins, there's this sense that much of the country's history, and in particular some of the, you know, the conquest, I think is the right word for it, that we did during the Mexican-American War, you know, was unjust. And if anything, sort of reflected the what contemporaries would call the slaveocracy of the South, these, you know, wealthy white slave owners who had sort of driven U.S. foreign policy, in large part because they were interested in expanding the number of slave states. And so General Grant, for instance, in his memoirs, writes that the Mexican-American War was one of the most unjust wars that had ever been fought. President Lincoln famously had been opposed to it during the 1840s. And so the kind of, you know, associated concept of manifest destiny, I think, is less popular post-Civil War than it was before. And certainly you don't see that same sort of hunger for annexationism that you had, you know, in the run-up to the Civil War, with a few exceptions around the time of the Spanish-American War.
So in the book, you divide some of the ideas that are going through into eras. So if we get into the first era would be Civil War to like 1898, and you're really, there is some concern with maintaining stability in these other countries in the Western Hemisphere. 1898 to 1918, this is this second era. And now in this period, we don't hesitate to openly meddle in other nations in this hemisphere. And it really is hard to count the number of times that the United States aggressively intervenes in some other countries.
That's exactly right. I mean, in that two-decade period, I think we were using force against our neighbors an average of nearly twice a year. There's this just remarkable rampage that we go on around the hemisphere. And in a lot of ways, it's a gradual and sort of reluctant process. I mean, the first era that you mentioned from the Civil War to 1898, the United States was trying to stabilize its neighbors, but it was trying to do so in a sort of indirect way that more or less respected their sovereignty. And so, you know, there were reciprocity treaties to kind of lower tariff barriers and help encourage trade in a way that the U.S. thought would be kind of stabilizing for these countries. There's kind of diplomatic efforts. And then, of course, there's efforts by the United States to beat back any European powers that seem too interested in the hemisphere. But in the wake of the Spanish-American War, we end up in possession of Cuba at the end of the war. And on the one hand, we've promised to give Cuba its independence. But on the other hand, there's this concern that if we do just give Cuba its independence, it's going to make decisions that eventually lead it to sort of become one more, you know, failed or failing state on the U.S. border. And the result will be that a nation like Germany is going to come in and take it over. And what the U.S. does is it requires Cuba to accept something called the Platt Amendment, which is these conditions that basically constrain Cuban sovereignty in a way that the U.S. thinks will help Cuba remain stable and sort of able to defend itself against a European power. It doesn't quite go that way. And so what you end up seeing for the next two decades is the U.S. trying more and more to adjust, to meddle in its neighbors' internal affairs in ways that will help stabilize and strengthen them, but finding that most of what it does just makes the situation worse. And so the U.S. ends up being kind of drawn further and further and further into these countries' affairs until by the end of that two-decade period, the U.S. is, you know, occupying two entire nations, Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and it's occupying parts of three more, Panama, Cuba, and Nicaragua, and it's massively involved in a number of other countries in the form of protectorates and customs receiverships and all these other kind of diplomatic tools of control that really are just, you know, really incredible in just how aggressive and interventionist they are.
No, there's the third era of the U.S. regional policy that you talk about in the book. So 1918-1945, the World War One ends. The United States is now a full-blown regional hegemon. You no longer have to worry about any serious threat in the hemisphere. Herbert Hoover is the person who, it seems to me, in reading the book, kind of wants to stop all of this intervention here and intervention there and the use of force and that sort of thing and try to be a better neighbor. Is that an accurate reading, and how does he do that?
So starting in the, I think, early 1920s, American leaders first realized that they are in this now secure position. They don't really need to worry about Europe coming, crossing over the ocean into the hemisphere anymore because Europe has just essentially blown itself up in World War One. And so there is this sort of, throughout the 1920s, this sort of gradual withdrawal. There's a lot of domestic criticism of the things that the United States is doing in the region. And before, that criticism sort of fell on deaf ears because there were these kind of overriding security interests that, you know, that took precedence. But now that those are gone, this criticism starts to have real bite. And so you have these string of American presidents who really start to kind of pull back and unwind much of the American sphere of influence that's been created. But as you said, Hoover is really the one who I think takes this most seriously. When he's elected president, he does the unprecedented, and he takes a 10-week trip before his inauguration around the hemisphere to visit 10 different countries. And everywhere he goes, he gives speeches about how the United States is now going to be a good neighbor. And Hoover largely, I think, lives up to that promise. He inherits a number of ongoing interventions that, you know, he tries to wrap up and doesn't always do at kind of you know, as quickly as he would like. But there is this pretty clear precedent set that the United States is just not going to intervene anymore. And that's, I think, where the story sort of picks up when FDR comes into office in 1933.
So after the second era, do our neighbors really trust us after so many interventions?
Oh, not at all. I mean, they, you know, in large part because they've been hearing this sort of rhetoric all the way from the beginning. And I think that's what's, I at least found really remarkable, because you would sort of think, looking at this interventionist record, that the United States had sort of done this with some gusto. But a large amount of the times, the American policymakers that were launching these interventions were doing so quite reluctantly. And you see that not only in their public speeches, but also in the way, you know, the letters they're writing to their immediate families, their closest friends and all that. And they sort of see it as oftentimes a last resort. But, you know, from the perspective of our countries, whether it was the first resort or the last resort doesn't change the fact that there are now U.S. Marines, you know, walking through your capital and U.S. Navy ships off your coast. And so by the time we get to the 1930s, there is this massive storehouse of distrust that FDR really needs to try and overcome to execute his good neighbor policy.
You know, when you read most of the material that's been written about our foreign policy with regard to our neighbors to the south, it puts us defending our business interests as the primary reason we did what we did. And you say that is part of it. But the overarching thing is, again, maintaining order in terms of the hemisphere and keeping people out.
Exactly right. There's certainly, especially in the 1900s and the 1910s, there are these massive companies, including in particular the banana companies, as well as some of these large Wall Street banks, that start to expand their footprint across the hemisphere and oftentimes get involved in the politics of these nations in a really deleterious way. And so companies like United Fruit and some of these other banana companies quite frequently are supporting revolutions or civil wars because they want to get, you know, the leaders they prefer into power in order to, you know, get nice tax breaks and something like that. And so there really is this, you know, sort of U.S. businesses are running amok to a certain extent. The thing that's sort of surprising, though, is that the U.S. government is not encouraging this full-throatedly. In fact, oftentimes it's working against it. And in internal documents, you can sort of see U.S. policymakers growing more and more frustrated at the way that U.S. businesses are acting in the hemisphere. And there's this amazing quote in the context of, a U.S. naval patrol in Honduras, where there was this Navy officer who was reporting back to the Navy Department and in turn the State Department about this, you know, kind of bitter dispute between two banana companies in Honduras. And the State Department sends back this reminder, "We are after bigger game than bananas." And it's this sort of reminder that what the U.S. is concerned about and what the State Department is concerned about in particular goes far beyond the, you know, profit margins of one company or anything like that. And so Washington is very happy to work with these U.S. businesses to advance its interests, but it is really, I think, more of an alignment of kind of objectives than it is the U.S. sort of, you know, full-throatedly trying to help U.S. businesses do whatever they want to do.
And of course, World War II happens. There is concern, again, about the troubles that are in Europe and some of those troubles coming here. And again, what happens is this—the problem of order that you allude to all along in the book—that comes back once again, as particularly toward the end, when you've got the end of the Second World War, and you've got the Cold War starting up.
That's exactly right. So the U.S. For most of its history up until this point has been concerned about instability, these kind of power vacuums developing in its hemisphere in a way that might invite foreign expansion. And at the end of World War II, it realizes that it is facing that exact same problem, but at a global level. Because what has happened is World War II has essentially devastated the entire European continent, you know, from France all the way to the borders of the Soviet Union. And American policymakers realize, or at least think they understand, that if they don't do anything, that entire European-wide power vacuum is going to tempt the Red Army to sort of move west until it takes over the entire continent. And for a variety of reasons, some ideological, some kind of based in, I think, U.S. security interests, the United States realizes that it can't let that happen. And so for the first time in American history, you really see the United States willing to station its forces abroad in the form of NATO and kind of other arrangements and get really, really involved in the politics of Europe and sort of take on this role, you know, as standing on the other side of the Iron Curtain from the Soviet Union to represent the free world and defend it.
Now, this is even going beyond that era. This is even the case in the 60s. I'm going to play for you. This is an audio clip from the inaugural address of John F. Kennedy. And the words that he is using could have come from just about every president before him, especially when you take a look at the arguments that you make in the book. Listen to this.
To our sister republics south of our border, we offer a special pledge to convert our good words into good deeds, in a new alliance for progress, to assist free men and free governments in casting off the chains of poverty. But this peaceful revolution of hope cannot become the prey of hostile powers. Let all our neighbors know that we shall join with them to oppose aggression or subversion anywhere in the Americas. And let every other power know that this hemisphere intends to remain the master of its own house.
Clearly, there are some things in what's being said by John Kennedy that he has in common in terms of what's been said in past eras.
Absolutely. There's this, I think, real continuity between pre-Cold War U.S. regional policy and Cold War global policy. The United, in fact, a lot of these programs, like the program that President Kennedy mentioned in his inauguration address, as well as, for example, you know, the Marshall Plan for Europe, these programs are indirectly and oftentimes explicitly based on programs that the U.S. developed for the region in the 1930s and earlier. So foreign aid as a sort of tool of foreign policy was something that was really pioneered first by FDR in the 1930s towards Latin America in response to the perceived threat from Nazi Germany. And so a lot of these tools, a lot of these foreign policy approaches end up getting pioneered in the Western Hemisphere and then used on a global level during the Cold War. And so I think the Kennedy inauguration address is just a perfect example of that.
You know, at the heart of what Joe Biden said at the beginning of his term, there were two very familiar words that he talked about: security and prosperity for the region. Very similar to what we're hearing from John Kennedy and what we heard in the past. So has there been any deviation from this traditional idea, this approach to being the master of our own house?
In a sense, the answer is yes, but in another sense, the answer is no. And what I mean by that is that the United States, I think, has always aspired to a set of regional relationships that are sort of founded on prosperity and peace and sort of these relationships that are on the whole quite good and don't involve the U.S., you know, waving a bat over its neighbors' heads and threatening them with anything or, you know, much less intervening in their affairs. And the U.S., I think, has tried to achieve that kind of that set of relationships at times when it doesn't see its security as threatened. And so in the early 1930s, in particular under FDR, as well as after the end of the Cold War, when there really wasn't a threat to the region anymore, the U.S., I think, kind of tries to move in that direction on the whole. And of course, I'm generalizing, so there certainly are exceptions. Mm-hmm. But in general, relations with the region tend to be peaceful when we don't see an external threat to the region. But when we do see that external threat, whether it's the European powers in the run-up to World War I, or, you know, the fascist powers in the run-up to World War II, or the Soviet Union during the Cold War, then we tend to prioritize security over prosperity. And that's, you know, usually when the U.S. Navy starts, you know, coming out and we start doing the things that I think later generations of Americans tend to regret.
So we started talking, we started out talking about the United States and being a regional behemoth. Russia and China, is this what their goal is, to be in their area what we are in the Western Hemisphere?
I think that's the case. Whether that's realistic or not is a sort of different question. You know, I think Russia, for instance, understands that it has a long way to go before it can really say that it's the only great power in its immediate neighborhood. But it's certainly true, if really for any nation, that all things considered, you would like to be the most powerful state in your neighborhood. Why not? It would guarantee your security and your survival much better than any other sort of arrangement. It's just that very few powers have the opportunity to kind of pursue that. And it's only really great powers like Russia and China today that are in a position where they could realistically try to accomplish that.
Now, how about China? China wants to be, clearly wants to be the, what can you say, the total power with regard to its area in Asia. That seems to be where they want to be headed. And they seem to be farther along at least at this point than maybe Russia is with its area.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the Russian military obviously is having tremendous trouble just in Ukraine. And so it's not a, I think, realistic possibility that Russia is going to be a great power or a regional hegemon anytime soon, not least because China is also in its neighborhood. And so at some point there would have to be a conflict there that is, I think, for the moment, at least in the future. China, on the other hand, you know, has become so powerful that it really does have a realistic shot, I think, at regional hegemony. And a huge part now of the U.S. security strategy is essentially preventing that from happening, both because for China to accomplish its goal, it will have to essentially eject the United States from East Asia, which, needless to say, the United States does not want to happen. But also because the lesson that I think the United States learned from its own rise to regional hegemony is that once a great power achieves that kind of supremacy in its neighborhood, it really has very few geopolitical constraints that prevent it from getting very involved abroad. And so one of the points I make in the book is that part of the reason that the United States was able to come in World War I, to come in World War II, and to so resoundingly defeat its opponents is precisely because it didn't need to worry about any other great power at its doorstep. And that kind of the privileges that come with regional hegemony are really quite great. And so we shouldn't be surprised that China's pursuing it, and we shouldn't be surprised that the United States, I think, is going to try and prevent it.
Author, scholar, and attorney Sean Mirsky has been with us this hour. His extraordinary book is We May Dominate the World: Ambition, Anxiety, and the Rise of the American Colossus. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Just look for KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast, or you can go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.